Yesterday, we're going to talk about assumptions of regression analysis become violated, what we can do about it, and whether violations are a threat or an opportunity. And this also marks the... That's also useful for keeping the camera not overheating. This is also our final session about regression analysis. And then after this session, we will do two sessions on measurement. And this part, we have just assumed that we somehow have some numbers to analyze. And we've been thinking about how do we model using regression analysis and how do we deal with other explanations. And next, we'll take a look at where do we get the numbers and how do we justify that our numbers actually measure things that we are interested in measuring. And then in the final seminar is going to be more about research ethics. We're doing research, looking at some errors in published papers, and perhaps a bit on where the field is going in qualitative research. After today, you should have a good understanding on how to answer these questions. So this is the learning diary questions. This far, the first 11 are about modeling. The remainder are about measurement and general issues about research designs. So let's try. And who wants to be the unfortunate person to answer a question? So let's pick one. Let's pick Anu. Can you explain what is endogeneity?
No.
No. You cannot. Try it.
No, give me a hint.
Endogeneity. Give her a hint, somebody. Eric, can you give it?
Common cause. Common cause, perhaps. Or...
It wasn't they have some kind of a...
Okay, let's try somebody else. So Xenia.
It's basically endogeneity problem arises when we have some causes that are not modeled in the model, but they still influence our dependent variable, and they can be correlated with independent.
Yes. So whenever we have a regression model, we have the error term there that presents all other causes of variation of the dependent variable. And because we can't model everything. Typically, we have if we have a really good model, it can explain about 20% of variation. So 80% of the variation of firm performance or team performance or whatever dependent variable is often unexplained. So we have most of the things that matter. Are beyond the scope of the model. And we have to assume that those other things are not correlated to the things that are in the model. This is the most important assumption in regression analysis. All right. How do we deal with endogeneity?
Instrument variables, for example?
Yes. The best way to deal with endogeneity is to avoid the problem in the first place. So it's always like, if you have a problem, then rather than thinking about how do I solve this problem, you should always think in advance, how do I avoid this problem in my research design? So for example, when it comes to endogeneity, you need to think about what might be the other leading causes of my dependent variable, and might they be correlated with anything that I want to study? If yes, you need to think about how to deal with that correlation. Do you perhaps need to constrain your sample to some specific industry, for example, in which case there wouldn't be any variation in some of the factors that might cause endogeneity, or should you perhaps include some additional control? What is the idea of an instrumental variable?
Going to find a variable that is not correlated with the error term, in order to somehow distinguish between the effect that it has. To distinguish between the effect that it comes from all the unmodeled clusters and the independent options.
Okay, there's someone to explain something.
So there are two dimensions that we study, relevance and exclusion.
Mm.
Relevance means that the instrumental variable has to be correlated with the independent variable, but it should not be correlated with the error term.
Yeah.
That's the exclusion criteria.
And finding valid instruments is a really hard problem.
Yes.
You might have in an experimental design, if you have a randomized variable, and then you think that your treatment is the only mechanism through which your randomization causes the outcome, then you can use the randomization as an instrument for the actual treatment. And this was something that Mokhon did. So they had the points, whether a person decides to like the Facebook group page of the wellness organization, almost certainly also is co-determined by things that affect points acquisition. So if you're active within the community, you're more likely to like the page, and then you're also more likely to acquire points. But, and also, when they invited people to like the page, then not everybody liked it, so people declined. But we know that the invitation to like and the actual like action, they are highly correlated. They showed that in their data. And there's no other plausible mechanism that inviting people to like a page, how it would affect points acquisition. So they just argue that the actual act of liking is the only plausible mechanism through which inviting can affect point acquisitions. Therefore, the exclusion criteria can be assumed to hold. Do you want me to explain any of these questions at this point?
I just had a question, short question. Okay. We haven't seen how does the instrument new variable, how is it represented inside the regression equation?
How is it, you need to have two regression equations. So you would have two states, least squares is one example. I will bring the board here during the break, because I was late, I would not bring it yet. So we would have, if we have, let's say that X is an endogenous explanatory variable, Z is an instrument. Then you would have a regression model where X is the dependent variable, Z is the independent variable. And then you have another regression model where you have, instead of X, you have X hat. The hat is the caret symbol over X. And that means that it's the fitted value of X from the previous equation. So we have two equations. So that is one way to present it. So this is the, we have a few models with two equations on this course or more, and that is one. Any other questions about these learning diagram questions or comments?
I'm still a bit, rusty on how do we differentiate between models and estimation techniques. So, for example, in this, what we were starting to analyze linear models, but sometimes you're also referring to maximum likelihood estimation.
Mm-hmm.
So, how do we differentiate?
Does anyone of you know what is the difference between a model and estimation?
I think the model is just how we make the two variables together and how you present them, and estimation is a way to estimate the correlation.
Yeah, model is just an equation. It's just an equation. It has some knowns and some unknowns. So the X and the Y are nodes. They are the things that we have measured them, they are fixed values, variables. And then we have unknowns, the regression coefficients and various variables that we want to estimate. And estimator is any kind of like technique or algorithm that allows us to come up with an estimate. So we could say that a mean is a model. So that's a very simple model. We just have one, we call it, for example, M, and then take the sum of everybody's height and divide by the number of people. That is an estimation algorithm of the mean. So that is the what we call estimator. Any other questions?
Just wondering about the number 10.
Number 10?
Yeah.
You know, while plotting adjusted predictions or maximum predictions for non-animals, it's always a good idea.
Yeah. Does it have something to do with like exponentiality? I'm not really sure what the answer to that would be.
Okay. I would say that plotting is always a good idea. Sometimes you just don't have a space for your plot in your paper. But plotting, for example, if you have a U-shaped effect, now I will have to get the board because this can be this.
How dare you make this alone?
The room with the board is locked. So we will have to get the other board. How do I make this go up with some here?
And then a little bit left.
That one, yeah. So, when we have, let's say, we have an equation y equals beta 0 plus beta 1 x plus beta 1 x plus beta 2 x squared. And let's say that beta 1 equals 1, and then beta 2 equals minus 0.3, for example. Can we say that the effect of x follows a new shape?
Sure.
So can we say that the effect of x is first up and then down?
Well, I guess it depends on the value.
If x varies between, let's say, 0 and 5. Can we now say that it is first up and then down?
Well, in the first, if it's just the quadratic equation, that, you know, if you don't assume any values of x, then yes, it can be either U-shaped or inverted U-shaped. But if you're limiting the x range to 0 to 5, so it's not really sure whether...
You know, but you always have to limit the backwards, because, for example, revenues can be negative, age can be negative, share of women in an occupation can be negative, it can be over 100. So there's pretty much always like a practical range of a variable. And we need to understand how does the curve that this model represents, how does it behave in the range of our data. And if you are really good at math, and you remember your high school, you might remember how you calculate the inflection point of the parabola. It's like minus two divided by eight. Yeah, you can calculate whether it falls out of the inflection point, but most people don't remember their math that well. So for most people, it's just easier, a lot more intuitive to plot. So this is a parabola. It goes something like that, and then we just look at, okay, so this is the range of our data. It doesn't look like it's a new shape. It kind of like goes up and then flattens. Another thing, if you have an exponential model, like a Poisson regression model or log transform dependent variable, it's a lot easier to understand what does the result look like, what does the result mean when you plot it. And then when you show your data in the same plot, then it also provides you some evidence of whether that model actually explains the relationships in the data. This U shape is something that we just decided that this is what we want to model. So this is our choice, the functional form. And then we need to verify whether it is the data. One way to show that, well, this is what the data look like, this is the curve, and they seem to match is the plot. So plotting is useful for at least two reasons. One, it supports your choice of functional form, and two, it makes it easier to understand the nature of the effect. And yeah, third point, it makes it easier to understand what's the magnitude of the effect. So when you have your data plotted as a scatter plot, and then you draw a line, you can see, okay, if we go from the extreme, from the minimum of x to the maximum of x, how much does y change and how much does that compare to the range of y? If the change in y is small compared to the overall range of y, if, for example, you say that going from, let's take an example, effect of education on income. If the minimum education, let's say 9 years, maximum education, let's say 20 years, if that increases your salary by 10 units, and the overall salary variation is in tens of thousands of units, like we talk about annual salaries, then 10 units is not an effect that we should even talk about. It's practically zero. So plotting useful for check. Verify that your functional form is correct. Checking what does the effect look like? Is it first up and then down, or are we just looking at this part of the curve, for example, and then understand the magnitude of the effect? Did that answer your question?
Yeah. It's also called linear models, but most of the time, this is somebody asked it on the forum. The journals are space constrained. They don't want to have 50 things articles, so you have to give something out, and I guess we think that data amounts are so easy to think of it that we don't plot. The most typical comment that I get during a final run, did you have something about the plot?
We also have the example like if we are modeling interaction effects and plotting. So like though some of those effects can be non-significant even though when we plot we sort of see that we actually the shape of the curve is solved or whatever. I think we have to use the example.
Yeah, if you have like if you look at for example logistic curve and it goes like that, and then for one group of observations the curve is like that within the range of the data. And for others, it is like that. It might not be that there is, we're just looking at the different part of the logistic curve for these two books. But so there is not necessary interaction between two variables involved, but the effect looks very different. Yeah. This is kind of like a get out of jail card for you. If your interaction term is non significant in paper, and then you have a nonlinear model. You can plot the data and tell your reviewer that even though we have a non-significant interaction effect in our model, our plots tell a different story. And I've used that successfully in the paper. I've also written about that in the paper, and I've seen others use that successfully in the paper. And that's actually because you're not really interested in the individual coefficients, like the significance of the coefficient doesn't really matter that much, in as much as we are understanding what does the model tell us about the phenomena that we're studying? And the plotting is the easier way of explaining that. Yeah, what I was going to say that the page limitations in journals are a thing, like pretty much every other paper that I've published, the editor in the final round says that, yeah, I like the paper, maybe 10 pages shorter. It's like, we just got a conditional acceptance in journal of my psychology. And then the editor says that, yeah, you have made 5 different studies in a paper, and still it's 80 pages, and we would prefer to have 8 papers at most 70 pages when they are multi-study papers, including references and tables. So they want to have 40 pages of main text and 30 pages of other stuff. So, yeah, space constraints, and then you put stuff online to act on it. Any other questions about these learning ladder questions that you would like me to explain? Take a look at this question. Start preparing your answer now because we will not cover these in detail anymore. And then if you have questions, use the course board. Let's move on to the second next topic. And the next topic is recursion assumptions. And so we have these six assumptions. And we have discussed before that some of them are more important than others. Is there something that is not important at all?
I suppose MLR 6 normality it's important.
It's not important. Okay. It's needed to prove that regression analysis is the p-values behave correctly in small sample, basically. But the p-values behave well in large samples even without this assumption. And in practice, large sample is like maybe 30, 20. And the p-value starts to behave well, even without this assumption. I've never seen this assumption, failure of this assumption to cause any problems. If the other assumptions hold, I don't
know. Why is it then like a regression assumption in the first place?
Because you need it to prove that regression analysis works regardless of the assumptions. So somebody has done the math and proven that the ratio of regression estimate to its standard error follows the t-distribution, regardless of the sample size. To do that proof, you need to make this assumption. If you say that regression analysis, the regression coefficient divided by standard error follows the t-distribution, which is needed for the significance testing in large samples, you prove that, then this one is no longer needed. It's here also, because on this course, because a lot of people make a big deal about the normality of the data, completely unnecessarily. Non-normality can indicate that there's non-linearity going on, and then the non-linearity is the issue, or it can indicate that you have outliers, like you have extreme cases that obviously will be in your sample. That is a problem, but the non-normality is not itself a problem. Is there something that is super important?
Random sampling?
Not necessarily. The random sampling can be. What does random sampling mean?
That the observations are independent.
That's one aspect of random sampling. So random sampling means that observations are independent. So that's one thing, and it means also another thing. Endogeneity is about this zero conditional. Okay. But random sampling, yeah.
They have the same probability of being in the sample, or being chosen.
That's the definition of random sampling. Every unit in a population has the same probability of being in the sample. But random sampling has two important features. It guarantees that the observations are independent, and also it guarantees that the sample is not biased. If you are only studying, for example, high-income individuals, when you want to study the effect of education and income, it might be that you get an incorrect result with errors of sampling bias. Sampling bias is pretty much always bad. Is non-independence of observation always bad? Is it a bad thing to have many observations of the same company over time?
That's
a
research question. Depends on the research.
Sometimes non-independence is a useful feature of the data. So, is there something else that is super important?
The first one, linearity of the parameters.
That is semi-important, because even if the line is not the correct feature of your data, we'll talk about this a bit later today, a line can still be a useful approximation. What is the most important of this assumption?
I would say maybe number three.
Number three. Yeah, in the sense that you can't even run regression analysis if that fails. But you should notice that. So in that sense, that's easy to see. So it's not that important because you will notice the failure of this assumption, I hope. So this is the most important thing. Zero condition and no endogeneity. And I cannot think of a scenario where endogeneity is actually useful. Let's talk about linearity.
I had a question about what does zero conditional mean? I understand endogeneity, and that's a term that is not familiar. But where does that term come from?
Well, this is just like a technical way of saying the zero conditional mean basically means that there are. The mean of the error term, it does not depend on any of the explanatory variables. That's a bit stronger assumption than saying that the error term is not correlated with the explanatory variables. Because you can have if you have this kind of relationship where like a curve, so this is your y. This is your x. There is no correlation because correlation is a measure of linear association. But we would have the mean of y depends on x. So this is like no statistical association. There are different ways of writing these assumptions. The important thing to understand is that no endogeneity practically means that the error term should not correlate with the independent values. So that is what it means. But with only that assumption, without this stronger form, you might not be able to complete some proofs. But we are not here to complete proofs, we are here to understand in which case this regression analysis gives us trustworthy results. Is this a big problem? Almost get asked.
Yes, because if the second errors are If there's a hyperspeed acidity, that means that this standard error is going to be biased and inconsistent.
But can you deal with it easily?
Yes.
So it's not that big of a problem. Let's think about these three assumptions. Assumption number one, assumption number two, and assumption number five. And this part, we have discussed this more of as problems. So they are biases of assumptions that, and they are something to be dealt with. But can they actually also be opportunities? So if you have if you identify that the regression model, the line, is not a good explanation of the data, is it always a problem or can it also be an opportunity? Or what kind of opportunities would it open up when we see that, okay, our residual is fit the plot so that we are a non-linear relationship?
Could there be an outlier?
Outlier might be a problem, but if we see that there's more systematic evidence of the non-linear relationship.
Yeah. Well, if the sort of prior theory states that, okay, there's a linear relationship between these two variables and we find that now there's issue with that, and we can perhaps write a new paper or test the theory and it moves on.
Yeah, you could say that prior theory argues that when we increase R&D, then our profitability increases. But we discovered that there's actually an inflection point in which the effect turns to be zero or even negative. That allows you to develop more theory. Or refine existing theory, or find boundary conditions. Or if prior theory has only, or theories typically don't say it about functional forms, but if everyone has tested something using just linear regression, and then you saw convincingly that actually there's an exponential effect, and this means that the effect is a lot more important in absolute terms if you have high values of Y already. It allows you to refine existing gear. So this violation of functional forms assumption is also an opportunity to contribute to existing theory. If you don't buy my word on this, there's a good book by Jakob and Jacobi on model building, and they argue strongly for finding different patterns, not just lines in data. How about random sampling? So if that is violated, is it ever an opportunity?
I guess, for example, if we have a sample that is self-selected, it's like a group of people from the population, and we have some kind of an effect, we can have an opinion about this group.
Sampling bias, when we have self-selection, that was always a problem. We would prefer not to have that. So all things, but there's the other form when we have cluster data. So the observations are not independent, but rather they belong to a small number of clusters. Is that ever an opportunity?
We may be interested in different levels. For example, setting something if you have like firms in an industry, right? And we have industry data too. So we could study two things. We could study at the firm level, or we could study at the industry level. So we might be interested in multiple clusters. Mm-hmm. And we can also be interested in within effects and between effects. Mm-hmm. That can also be something that can be explored.
Yeah, it allows us to more precisely study causal effects. So for example, if you observe companies and you just observe each company once, and you find that the company R&D spending and the profitability is correlated, you would like to make a claim that increasing R&D spending causes profitability. But you don't really know whether that's the case unless you have multiple observations for each company, where you can say, after which you can say that when a company increases their R&D spending, then their profitability increases. So that will be the winning company. You can just say that there's an association, but we don't know whether it's something that some companies are just tend to be more profitable and they tend to spend more R&D. This is the between company effect. And we can say that that it is when we manipulate something within a company, of course, it stays in another company. I tried to come up with an example of a correlation on the way here, and I came up with this. So if you think about the adults and their the correlation between height and weight in an adult, then, and let's be more specific, correlation between height and weight in adult males, there's a strong correlation, positive correlation. But if you consider it a winning person, you can't say that you can make yourself taller by gaining weight. And you can't say that you can make yourself heavier by growing taller, because on an individual level, the height is constant throughout your adult life until you become like an elder and start to get a bit shorter. So that is purely a between person correlation. There is no within person effect of height and weight.
There was also this, I see this example of penguin beaks. And
their
sample width, and
that
is also something that can be.
Yeah, that is a big mean effect. You can't change the peak of a penguin, I assume. So this allows us to study better different causal effects. How about heteroscedasticity? Megaphone opening left or megaphone opening right? Is it ever an opportunity?
Can I say something about the observations? And then we can model something about the differences in observations, but I cannot go deeper into this. Like, that some observations are just more, like, the most influential observations are doing it, and they're kind of different from other ones. If we didn't model it as a difference in the model. But I cannot come up with examples.
So I can, because I've written a paper about. Paper, an empirical study, where we have heteroscedastic data, and our main point is heterostatic. So if you think about regression analysis, then regression analysis tells you where is the mean of the data. So what is the average level of, for example, growth? And risk. Let's assume that X is risk-taking, and then Y is growth of firm. We might find that the effect of risk-taking on growth, it's positive but fairly small effect. If you just look at what is the effect of risk-taking on average growth rate, it's positive but fairly small. But that hides the fact that when you increase risk-taking, then the variance of the growth outcomes increases a lot. So when you take risks, sometimes it pays off and then you grow a lot, or sometimes it backfires and then your company suffers and the growth declines. If you don't take risks, you're just going to stay the same size. And I'm writing a paper about this where we are looking at what causes the variation in growth rates like what causes the variation around the regression line. That is not something that a lot of people look at. Also, if you have like a megaphone opening right, then another thing that you could think about is that, well, it might be that there's actually a moderation going on. So it might be that for some companies, there's the regression line goes up, for some companies it goes down, and then you just need to figure out what causes the line to go up for some companies and go down for some companies. And then that opens up new ways of building theory using your data. So this also can be thought of as an opportunity. So these are always, if you look at them through as regression assumptions, they are just a nuisance. You need to deal with them. But then when you change your model, it can actually become something that tells you something new about the phenomenon that you didn't know before. Any questions? Let's have a 10-minute coffee break.
Let's continue.
And so the second part will be about function forms, and we're going to look at this article first. This is from my colleague, John Antonakis. I just got an email from him, like this, a minute ago, about other matters. And I was substitute John in 2019 in Lausanne, so I was when he was in sabbatical. So we are good friends, and he knows that I'm using his paper as an example in the class. Their paper looks at what determines the total citation count of an article. And they are mainly interested in whether the quality of the empirics of an article determines whether it gets more citations. And they find evidence for the idea that if your article suffers from an endogeneity problem, then it receives less citations than if it doesn't. And that was what they set out to show. They are only looking at this one journal, Leadership Quarterly, and we are looking at the methods of this paper. And you can either open the paper on your own computer, just Google it, or you can read it from here. And read the first paragraph under estimation strategy. The first sentence. But the second sentence. Dependent variable is a comp requiring a Poisson type modeling procedure. The dependent variable is a count because it's citation count. But is it true that Poisson regression requires, that the count variable requires a Poisson model? No. It's not. When would you use Poisson model?
If the variance or the expected value of the mean is very close to zero or low, so you know, like under dispersion.
Why would you use Poisson regression instead of a linear regression? I'll let you ask her in a minute. So why would we ever want to use Poisson regression now?
When the function form is showing you that there is a non-linear relationship.
What kind of non-linear?
So exponential.
Exponential, yeah. So Poisson regression is the kind of, if you think about what is the basic tool for linear models, it's linear regression analysis with overlapping estimation. Mm-hmm. And Poisson regression is the same for when you have an exponential curve. So that's the real reason. Most articles that use Poisson regression model say that they use it because it's comparable. And I don't have any statistics on this, but I'm pretty sure that a lot of studies use Poisson regression incorrectly. They should use a linear model, but they pick exponential because they have a dependent variable that is a comparable. And it's completely illogical to say that I have an exponential relationship because my dependent variables are count.
So if you use a Poisson type model or regression, but you should use linear regression, does it distort the findings? Like, are your findings like wrong, totally wrong?
It depends on what you're trying to say. And if you're just trying to say that x, y increases the value of variables as x increases, both models will probably do the job. But typically, we would like to our models to be somehow close representations of the reality that they're trying to describe. So in that sense, it would be no. If you have a linear relationship, modeling it with an exponential curve would be incorrect.
I actually had a question about our data assignment too, because you wrote there that we can do Poisson, but it's like not a counter, right? So because and I had this question, so we don't need to have a look if it's out or not. We still might want to check for some type.
Yes, we can use Poisson. If your dependent variable is a count, and it's a count from Poisson type model process, which I have never seen anyone argue. You know, they just focus that it's a count. But that's not actually, the assumption is that it's a count that follows a Poisson process. I don't know what the Poisson process is. I've read about it, but I don't remember. So not every count qualifies for Poisson. But if it's a count that follows Poisson process, then your standard errors are going to be correct. But if it's not a count or not a Poisson type count, then you need to use robust standard errors.
Mm-hmm. And then I can still use Poisson.
You can still use Poisson. You should. Mm-hmm. It's that when you use when you model exponential relationship, Poisson regression is the default, and you should probably always use a robust standard errors because you don't know if it's actually, even if it's not, if it's a count, whether it follows the right count distribution or not. And now I have a question. This is from my paper on nonlinear models and organizational series of methods. And these are my data, and just some random data that I generated to make a point. And we have the independent variable is a number of throws. So we are throwing a coin, and the dependent variable is number of tails. So how many times it landed tails up. And we're modeling, this is a count of tails, the dependent variable. So according to the conventional wisdom, because the dependent variable is a count, we should use a Poisson type regression model. And then I'm using linear regression model as well. How would you interpret the linear regression? The linear regression result. So what does that result mean?
Well,
the coefficient is 0.504. What does it mean?
it's basically like the probability of getting jails if you expect a probability. It was just
it's a probability of tails crossing your throat, and if you throw the die one more time, throw the coin one more time, then expected increase in tails is 0.5. So whenever you increase throw by one, the expected increase is 0.5. And what does the integer tell us? It's close to 0. Yeah, if we're not throwing the die, then the coin. If we're not throwing the coin, we have no tails. So that is the word of tells us. And what is the limitation of the Poisson regression model? Odds is for wider outcomes. So odd is ratio of positive and negative outcomes. Probability. The dependent variable is the count of tails. So how would you interpret the Poisson result? 0.022. It's, if you think about how do you interpret a regression model where we have a log transport dependent value.
Yeah, percentage change.
Yeah, but the Poisson is exponential model versus a log transport dependent value. You can see log and exponent are inverse functions. So that's the same thing, like when, as far as the interpretation goes. So what is the interpretation of 0.02 here?
Does it mean that each throw increases the number of tails by 3% relative to the current number count of tails?
Yeah. Does it make sense? No.
Not really. No.
What is the intercept of 1.965? How would you interpret it? Well, it just tells that if we don't throw the coin at all, we have a statistically significant positive number of about 10 tails if we don't throw the die at all. It's pretty hard to interpret, and that's why we need to plot it. So if we plot these effects, we have linear regression. Number of tails increases exponentially linearly, and then we have Poisson regression, which says that they increase exponentially, and if we don't throw the coin at all, we are expected to have about 8 tails. And this is what people model when you put Poisson regression. So dependent variables count. It does not mean that you have to have an exponential model, and really, really smart people then figure out that, okay, I have these zeros here. My model doesn't really predict many zeros. Let's do zero-inflated Poisson regression model. So there are more zeros in my data than what my model indicates. So let's add zero inflation to my Poisson. I'll not talk about what that does. When in reality, the linear model is correct, and it just start approaching the model choice from a completely incorrect premise that the nature of the dependent variable should determine the model. It's not that, it's there, it's a function. So we can see here, Antonakis, they have their model predicts non-zero amount of citations, and they have zero article with zero citations, then they will just like when article is really published, it should expect to have pretty much zero citations, and then they have this zero inflation to add excess zeros to the Poisson. But this is, to this article's credit, they have this, we don't need to care about what's the moderation here. I think it is the number of articles published in the journal volume. But they model the effect of the number of citations as a function of article 8. Is it realistic that the number of citations increases exponentially as the article gets older?
Why not? It's cumulative citations all its time. So after the until the sort of stream phase or something matures, so perhaps even a master at some point.
Well, what if we have article 8 from 0 to 100 years? Is it increased? Does it increase exponentially? This might explain a part of the article citation, how it accumulates, but probably like at some point there's a decline that the article gets less and less attention. So let's start thinking about this problem. Let's think it from without knowing the data. Let's start thinking how do we think that the article citations, without being constrained by any model. So pick a pair, take a piece of paper, and draw how you think the article citation might develop over time. And you can go way beyond, like, let's just not focus on the first 10 years, let's go up to 30 years. So a typical article, not like something that becomes a classic. So pick a pair, and then draw, how do you think the citation count?
Yeah, it might catch up.
Is it that I'm not proper?
I think it's going to be like, for example, a project.
Yeah. So it might have a lot of zeros.
But then eventually, And I think that, you know, how often do we quote or reference articles from? I think that, you know, how often do we quote or reference articles from? But we have to think about one thing. Is it ever going to be zero? Is it going to be touching zero?
Oh, yes, true, because it's a
deposition. Or is it just going to be like, you know, flat? Is it going to be flat?
So that's something that will change. It might be like some years
after years,
it can have a still I want to read this.
But the thing is that we saw this British space in infinity, so maybe that's not what happens.
Let's start talking about this as a class. And how many of you were smart enough to start thinking about this as yearly citations instead of total citations? You were smart enough.
We just specified it. For us, it's total, not yearly.
Yeah, because if you know one, then you can infer the other. But this is a lot easier to think about in terms of yearly citations. And if you think about what is the dependent variable, the total number of citations you would have to model the various life cycles of the articles in your model, and it's like some articles have a lot of citations because they are like something fashionable, so it peaks the citation count, and some articles have lots of citations because they build something more foundational. In which case, it might take like a lower increase, but then it lasts longer, and they produce the same cumulative citation. So, talking about yearly citations would be a lot easier in this case. Let's focus on the yearly citations, and how would the yearly citations look like? So where does it start? Article is published here. So this is the zero. Do we start from here?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or do we start from somewhere here?
Zero.
No.
It's specifics, probably.
It is because articles are often cited before they're published. So publication date is whenever it's printed in the journal, and articles are typically online first. When it's accepted in the journal, then it's put online. So how many of you have ever published an article? You have.
Well, it's currently in print, but we are wondering whether we should do a preprint or not.
But is it available on the journal website?
Not yet, but it will be like a couple of weeks
before
the conference.
Yeah, some journals are very fast. So the fastest that I've had is like I get an acceptance decision and then within 2 weeks it is on the journal website. And of course, when I have an acceptance decision now and then it's online there, it's not assigned to an issue right away. It might be a year before it's assigned to an issue, depending on how the journal has space in the print. So it might be that it's actually online here first, and then also it's possible that people are citing it even before it appears online. If you have an article that you think that it's fairly sure that it's going to be published, like I've cited my own work that is still under review process because I'm fairly confident that it's going to be published. And that comes as a citation to what that article when it is published. So it starts not from zero, but yeah, might be a few citations at the time of the publication. How does it go then? How do we? This is the theorizing of functional form. So we need to build some kind of theory. How do we think that they are the phenomena behaves over time? Sabir.
It's going to go up, but then it's going to peak at one point.
Up?
Yeah, like an exponential.
Why exponential? Why not linear?
It can be linear too.
Well, I can only draw one. Should I draw linear or exponential?
I think in the base case, it will be linear.
Or exponential, because in the beginning, not a lot of people will cite, but then as a little more people cite, then there's more people think it's credible, and then there's more number of people who will cite it more quickly.
Yeah, and if you think about the number of citations that the article receives, is the function of how many researchers know about it, and out of those, how many find it valuable. And as time passes, there is more researchers who know the article, so there is more potential citation. So the citation count does not increase linearly, but it probably increases like an exponential. Okay, so it starts like that, for example. And then how does it go from there?
Well, we thought of it that someone said it reaches a peak at some point. We maybe that 10 years. just a guess that 10 years it reaches its peak, and then it starts to have this longer tail. So it starts to go down and down. But we kind of theorized that it would have a longer tail than. We actually draw the zigzag, so it would
might be
never be maybe zero, but then a couple of years might be zero, then it gets one citation.
Yeah, but this is the expected, so
it goes
very close to zero. But it never goes exactly zero, because there's a non-zero chance that someone will, like if we write an article about the history of some kind of theory, or we write an article about what kind of empirical work this journal has published over 100 years, then we can have really weird citations to work that goes back 100 years. Okay, so it might look like that. And what would the cumulative curve then look like? The cumulative citations would look like something like that. Okay, it's not in state, but you can see the form. So once we have gone to this kind of what we think based on theory or the relationship between X and Y should look like, then how do we start modeling it? How do we build either of these curves from our data, from the things that we know?
I think the first step would be how many observations are lying in the straight line part of the S-curve.
We would have to know, yeah. So when we have a theory that this is how our data looks like, and let's say that we have 90% of our observations are from here. This is 90%. are in this range, and then this k is 10% of our push space, for example. How do we start building a model? We want to build a model that approximates these curves, either way.
Well, for the total citation curve, perhaps logistic regression.
That comes to mind, but it's incorrect, because logistic regression constrains the dependent variable to vary between 0 and 1. Inclusive. So, contrary to popular belief, logistic regression analysis can also model fractions. So, it doesn't have to be ones and zeros. Then you would need to use robust standard errors. This looks kind of like the logistic curve, that you're right. But logistic curve is bounded between 0 and 1. So, we wouldn't be able to model this goes up. If we think about Antonakis' decision to model exponential curve for the first 10 years, is it a bad choice?
I don't think it is. I think it's representative of the time frame that they chose. But the good question is that I was wondering that you should you then use another function to model the rest of it.
Yeah, one way we want to have the total citations, we could have up to this point, we could have exponential curve, like so, it would be here, something like that. Is it a good enough approximation? It's not ideal, but maybe it shows that it curves up. We are missing this bend here, but it doesn't really probably make a difference to our conclusions. Or we could also consider just using a line. So we could do a line here. Which one would be better? Line might be better than exponential. Both would be like okay. And then we could say that okay, our theory says that there are the number of citations starts to decline after 10 years. We could just split the data. We could have early year and then later years. And we could use either a line here, another line. We could model which articles are taken up, which determines like early adoption, first 10 years. And which determines the longevity of an article. So we can use these basic shapes that we have to model all kinds of effects. We could also, if this goes like up and then like this, we could have a square that can model this nonlinear relationship. It doesn't have to be going up and down. If the inflection point of the U-shape is like at 100 years, if we don't have data that far, we could have modeled these diminishing returns with h squared, for example. What if we want to model the annual citations? How would we construct this curve?
Poisson
is exponential. We could have one line here, another line here, and then third line here. We could have that, but we can actually build that curve as well. So we could build that curve. This is If you want to take a look at how the citations of articles behave over time, you can look at profiles of citation profiles over time in Google Scholar. So if you click on an author's profile and then you click on an article, you see that then how the article is cited over time. And they actually follow this kind of normal distribution, the long tail. And you can model this by having, so we know that it goes first up and then down. How do we model first up and then down? We model it with square. So first up and then down. So we would have A square. And then how do we model something approaching zero but never getting to it? Sorry.
Something that
we could do, isn't it? No, yeah, but something.
One divided by.
We go exponential. So we could have Poisson regression where we have h and h squared, and that produces this kind of curve. So how do we work with these nonlinear models? We can work in two different ways. The first way is that we go through this kind of like an exercise where we think, how does it look like based on theory? So for citations, we pretty much know how citation counts behave over time. We get some data from Google Scholar that we can use to support our theorizing of the functional form. And then we start thinking about, so thinking about it like, when we have drawn it on the board, I have a board in my office where I actually do this kind of drawing when I start modeling something. Then we start thinking, okay, so how do we model these curves using the functions that we know, the exponential, the quadratic, the square, and then the linear model? And should we split the data perhaps into different subsamples and have a different model for each subsample? And then we start with. So that's one way. Another way is to just do a linear model. And then you look at the linear model and you do diagnostics. You identify whether the model fits the data. If it doesn't, then we can start thinking, okay, so if the residual precipitate plot looks like nonlinear, how do we take that nonlinear into account by including more terms? I did this, I'll post it to the board. This is for a paper that I'm working on with Jeremy Dawson. We did this kind of like, I'll show it to you on live in a minute. So we did this kind of tool online where you can take a look at what different interaction models look like. So you can specify different models there and you can then decide, then look at what it looks like. So if you want to play around with different functional forms, I'll show it to you. Just a sec. So here's the it's actually slowly. Demo effect. Please wait. So this is for interaction models, and I will just do set the interaction coefficients to be zero. So I think we have just one line. And then Z is our moderator variable. If you want to not know what it looks like, we can just add a bit of curvature to the model. So it curves up or it curves down. And first up, then down. And if you want to see what it looks like when we change the link function to log to make it exponential, if we decrease this quite a lot, then we're gonna add the rings. This is demo effect. I should have planned, put this here in advance. But if those two are close to zero, or you can do logistic model and COVID models to see what it looks like. I'll let you play around with this in the computer lab more. But you can also do with your statistical software, or you can do it even in Excel. Just put the functions together and see what it looks like, and then whether it fits your data. I'll show you live demo in the computer lab. I also have other stuff in the computer lab, but I'll show you. So when you think about functional forms, it's always about either empirically by looking at how do the variables relate together, or based on theory, and then you do this kind of like a theoretical exercise, then you think about the different building blocks. It's never about the distribution of the dependent variables. So that is, a distribution can indicate that there's no linearity going on, but it doesn't really prove it. Then you just start modeling, thinking about how do I keep these curves together. And then you plot. The usability of my demonstrator is not as great as I would have. Any questions about non-linear models?
I had a question about the pseudo-R-squared. Mm-hmm. Can it go negative?
Pseudo-R-squared, can it go negative? It depends on which pseudo-R-squared you're talking about. They are like many, many different. Most pseudo-R-squares probably can't go negative. But some might. So can I find a pseudo R square that goes negative? Maybe. It might take some time. Any others? Pseudo R squares are something that I would really hope they would go away, because pseudo R squares, in regression analysis, R square is something that everyone knows, and there is one R square. But if you have a pseudo R square of 0.1, for example, and then you would like to have a bit larger value, you can just switch the different pseudo R square, that is for the same data, the same model, is 0.3. And it's very difficult to argue that one is better for a specific case compared to others. So pseudo R scores is something that I would not report. I would only add pseudo R scores if my reviewers wanted to have it. If I want to quantify how strong the associations are, then doing a plot like that for a nonlinear model, and then putting the data behind the plot to show that this is how my curves relate to the data, it's a lot more effective way of actually honestly arguing about the magnitude of the effect than any pseudo R score statistic. Any other questions about nonlinear models? If not, we can take a break. All right, let's continue. And I'm going to start with an example of Denver variance that I had on the videos, and then I will expand it a bit. And so, is profitability related to R&D investments? Yes or no? Yes, it's related. And from three different industries. Is profitability related to R&D investments? The problem is, that it is possible that there is actually an effect between industries that is positive, but within industries that is negative. And now the question comes is that they're related, there's a positive relationship on one level, and there's a negative relationship on another level. And it is a research design question which level you're interested in. And this is something that requires a bit of thinking, and we'll do this thinking now before we launch. But before we start thinking about it, let's take a look at if we run regression analysis that ignores the effect of clustering, which assumptions are violated? If we just run this regression model that shows that there's positive effect, but these are the data, and we're actually interested in the within industry effect. Which assumptions are violated? We want to answer the question that if a firm increases their R&D spending, how much would their profitability increase? We're not controlling for industry. Which assumptions are violated?
Is it independence of observations?
Well, that is violating because we have multiple observations within each industry. And the idea of non-independence of observations, if you think about clustering, then your standard errors would be incorrect. They would be incorrect because regression analysis assumes that every new observation brings the same amount of unique information to the data. But if your observations are clustered, then existing observations within a cluster also already carry a bit of information of every new observation. One way to understand this, why standard errors will be biased, is that if we think about measuring the correlation between height and weight, and then we have five individuals, even if we measure each individual 100 times, we gain no more information about the correlation between the height and weight, but our sample size increases. So the effective sample size, if we have 100 measures of each five individuals at the same time point, our effective sample size is still five individuals, but our regression analysis sees 500 lines of data, and it estimates the sample, the standard errors based on the sample size of 500 instead of the sample size of 5. And this is the problem, the cluster over standard errors. So yes, we have that problem, cluster over standard errors is a thing. What other? We have also another problem. Yes, we have an endogeneity problem. And we have an endogeneity problem because we are not modeling the effect of industry. So industry would be only back. So that's one way to understand the endogeneity effect, endogeneity problem. Another way of understanding the endogeneity problem is that this is something that the Antonakis et al. 2010 paper talks about, and they mention so-called random effects assumption. So regression analysis assumes that the within effect and the between effect are the same. If they are not the same, then regression analysis will give you incorrect results. Here, the between effect is positive. We can see that those industries that are higher on R&D are higher on profitability, but the within industry effect is negative. So when you have effects that go that are not the same on different levels, that also leads to an endogeneity problem unless you control for the level. If we can control for the level using industry dummies, for example. And that's the problems that we have.
the endogeneity problem is much more serious. So we will get the direction of the effect incorrectly unless we control for elasticity. We will get the standard errors incorrectly unless we control for rust strain, but having the effect in the correct direction is a lot more important than quantifying uncertainty of the estimates. Yeah.
I was thinking, how do we know what clusters to like analyze? Because it could also be that the one level would be the company size, but that has something to do with this. So how do we know what clusters?
So you group it based on small companies and large companies.
For example, yeah.
Yeah, that would be inadvisable generally, because if you have a continuous variable, then maybe breaking into the categories is losing information. And generally, losing information, converting from a continuous variable to small number of categories, it's bad idea, as a general rule. The clustering effect, we would typically have kind of some kind of natural grouping in the data. And if you group large companies and small companies, that's more of a grouping that you are doing for your data. But if we have industries, then the companies are competing within industries. They have the same kind of business models within industries. They have the same kind of asset structures within industries. There's a lot of things that are similar within industries. But if you take a small, let's say, pizza store and small startup, they are both small companies, but they might not have that much in common. So you need to think about what are the meaningful things in your study. Sometimes gender might be a meaningful clustering variable if you think that there are gender differences. Sometimes age groups might be, but most of the time probably not. So it depends on your research question and it depends on what you're studying. Industry, like geographic proximity, might be something. That's a very good question. Any other questions about clustering? Most often in strategy, the clustering variable of interest is industry. Companies are within industries because industry determines a lot what companies do. And then if you have longitudinal data, then whatever is your observational unit, like a company, that is a clustering variable. So you have multiple observations of individual cluster. If you have multiple observations of any individual, then that individual becomes a level in the variable. So here we have the other example that I have, sample of 15 companies over 10 years, we might have that the within company effect is negative, but the between company effect is positive. So it might be that some companies are just for some reasons they have, for example, the kind of business model that requires more R&D that is also more profitable, and then these companies that have business model that requires less R&D, then even if they increase their R&D, even then the profits might go down. So when you have time as one of the dimensions, then time is typically the lowest level in the data. And whatever repeated observations over time, typically of people or of companies, of teams, then the team would be the second lowest. And then if you have teams, they might be within companies might be within industries, so there might be a whole lot of levels in your data, like 3 or 4. Typically, we're interested in the lowest 1 or 2. The question about these levels is that it's a very important research design decision. Which level are you interested in? Are you interested in explaining why some companies are more profitable than others? Or are you interested in understanding what determines the profitability of a company? So what determines the profitability of a company? And why does profitability differ between companies? These are two different questions. Because if we say that profitability of a company is determined by R&D, then we could say, okay,
it changes your R&D spending, and that will change your profitability. But if it's more of a, like a beginning company effect, some companies tend to be higher, then changing R&D spending would not be a good policy recommendation. And this is something that was really hard for me to get my head around. And we have an example toward the end of the session. But let's focus on the two fallacies first. There's an ecological fallacy, means that we can generalize from higher level to lower level. So we would see that, okay, so in those industries that have higher R&D, have higher profitability, therefore, increasing R&D spending of my company causes their profitability to go up. This would be an example of an ecological fallacy, because we are generalizing from higher level to lower level. For example, if we identify that those people who are taller tend to be heavier, we cannot tell a person that gain weight to become taller. It doesn't work that way. That would be an ecological fallacy. There is no correlation between height and weight on an adult individual because height stays constant. Then there's the atomistic fallacy, which is less common because we're mostly interested in lower level units. We want to understand what companies should do. We're not that much interested in explaining why certain companies are better than others, like on the mid-tier level. But the atomistic fallacy generates from lower level to higher levels. We have four different effects. We have the weighted effect, we have the between effect, we have the contextual effect, and we have the population average effect. And out of these four that we can estimate, the weighted effect and the contextual effect have clear causal interpretations. And the weighting effect is the effect of one individual's actions, one company's actions, one individual's attributes on that individual. So it's effect from one to one. And then the contextual effect is the effect of one on everybody else within the cluster, or it's the effect of everybody else in the cluster to one. Let's go through this example. So vaccinations on health. What would be the weighting effect? The effect of vaccination on health.
Positive.
It's possible. What is the mechanism like?
You get a vaccination and you don't get sick.
If you get a vaccination and you are exposed to the virus causing the disease of the bacteria, you're less likely to get sick. So you become more resistant to get the disease, whatever causes the disease. That is the weighting effect. So when I take a vaccination, that protects me. What is the contextual effect of vaccinations? Is vaccination a completely self-esteem support?
So when you take the vaccination, the contextual effect is that you are less likely to have the disease and spread that around to the others.
Yes, so that's their third mm-hmm. Yeah. So the contextual effect and the weighting effect is positive, and because of the positive contextual effect, it actually means that not everyone in a community needs to be vaccinated to be pretty much safe. Depends on the disease, but if the vaccination rate is like 90% or something, then all disease outbreaks die out soon because there's not enough individuals that could be affected. Then let's assume that we have multiple lakes, so that is our level two, and on each lake we have multiple fishermen, and they are professional fishers. And they have quotas to preserve the fish population. What is the effect of overfishing on an individual level on profits? So should an individual fisherman exceed their quota?
Probably yes, because if they fish more, they gain more profit. So individually, it's profitable.
Okay, So the weakening effect of overfishing is possible. If fishermen exceed their quota, they catch more and they can sell more. What is the context of that?
It's negative because overfishing just means that there's less for everybody else.
Yeah, there's less for everybody else. If one fisherman overfishes, then other fishermen who spend the same amount of effort will catch less fish. So there's positive and negative. This is an example of positive and negative. How many of you have heard about the tragedy of the commons? That's an economics term. So what does that refer to?
Well, it's a game theoretical concept. So man loss. So what most of us interest us, I think that's what it's usually referred to as well.
Yeah, if you have like the classic example is farmland, and for each farmer, they should have as much cattle on the farmland as possible. But then there's erosion that destroys the farmland for everybody. But because it's nobody's land, no one maintains it, people just want to exploit it. And having your cattle on that farmland is the winning effect is positive, your cattle piece. But then for everybody, it's net negative because it's anything that's overfishing. Pollution, for a manufacturer to pollute, the effect on that manufacturer's well-being is positive, the effects for everybody else is negative. So we have these effects going different ways. Negative externalities. Innovativeness and competitive advantage. If a company innovates,
it should be positive if they create more in a hot competitive others. Unless they
How about the contextual effect?
Yeah, probably negative. If everybody innovates, not innovating. You are stable way of going.
If everyone innovates more and your innovation level stays constant, then you're falling behind. So that's the contextual effect. The contextual effect is if everyone else goes up and I don't, then what is the effect on me? So it's the effect of everybody holding my level constant. Or it is what is the effect of my actions on everybody. If one company innovates and they gain competitive advantage, then that decreases the competitive advantage of others because it's kind of like if you think about competitive advantage is defined in terms of like advantage over others. So it's not possible that everyone has a competitive advantage over everybody else. So that would be positive and negative. So if everyone in the industry innovates, innovations are no longer linked to competitive advantage. Then we have an interesting example. Gender on team performance. And now we need to think about, okay, so gender on individual level, it's approximating with a binary. So typically it's man or male or female, or man or woman. Yeah, this is gender, that's the psychological level. So it's man or woman. What does, if we think about teams, what is the gender variable? Varies between 1 and 0. If we individual level, 0 is man, 1 is woman. That's how it's typically coded for some reason. So what does it then mean on the team level? It's gender diversity. So you are all men, half and half, or all women. What might the effect be?
I would guess that probably mixed teams perform better, so gender on performance, I guess, it would be positive. I mean, the more genders, the more team performs, the better the team performs.
We would have a U-shape, inverted U-shape in the context of effect. Yeah, this is a politically correct example, so the gender effect is zero. For an individual, it doesn't matter whether you're man or woman. But for teams, the gender composition affects team performance. works. Being with Hoffman and Hoffman works best. So this is how you think about these effects is that you need to think about the effect of one on their performance, on the effect on others, in the effect of one on others. So for example, if you have team performance, and then you have a smart individual who is disclosed to that team, that smart individual can perform better than the other who are not so smart, but the smart individual can also improve the performance of others. Like if you have a really bright guy or girl who comes to the team, they might take a bit of a leadership position in that team and help everybody else perform. If a smart individual helps everyone else perform better, that's the contextual effect. If smart person performs better and then that increases the average team performance, that will be the weighted effect. The between effect is the sum of the weighted effect and the contextual effect. It is just like if we think about why certain populations are more better vaccinated, why certain populations are healthier than others because of vaccinations, it is because of both mechanisms. It's because individuals are less likely to get sick if individuals are vaccinated, but it's also because of herd immunity. So it's a sum of these two. If we want to understand the overall profit levels on fishing, then in this fishing industry, we would take a look at, okay, so how much, if overfishing increases the profitability of others, some, how much others suffer. So it's a sum of these two effects. The same with all of these others. Then the population average effect, that tells us that if we have a certain population, for example, if people in Finland, or people, or let's say a person in European Union with different countries having different countries, the clustering level, different countries have different vaccination rates. The population average effect tells us what is the expected health of an individual with vaccination, without vaccination within this sample. So it's more about predicting what is the likely outcome for an individual with a certain level of variable in that population. And in practice, the population average effect is a weighted sum of the weighted effect and the contextual effect. We don't see population average effects used that often in management research. Let's think about research questions and which effect we would have. And we have the empirical papers. So Deep House has 96-year observation nested in 159 banks, so they have like 7 years of data for each bank. Are they interested in the weighted effect, the between effect, the contextual effect, or the population average effect? They don't specify it explicitly. Let's ask a simpler question because there is a specific answer to this. Did Deep House estimate a within effect, a between effect, a contextual effect, or a population average effect? What is the effect that they estimate? If it's a big pin effect, what would their sample size be? Let's focus on what they estimate and then let's focus on or and then or he supposing a problem. Let's focus on first what he estimates. If you calculate the between effect, if you only focus on the between effect, how you would do it, is that you just take the cluster means of every variable, so you would calculate the average ROA for each band, the average search deviation for each band, and you would add those in the regression model, and you would have a model with 159 observations.
Yeah, now I saw it's minus 60.
So it's not between effect. The estimate is you can estimate two effects, by the way. You can estimate the within and contextual both in the same model. You can estimate the within and between both in the same model. But all these papers says is estimate one effect. So which effect do they estimate?
Similar effect.
Yep.
Could it be the contextual effect?
Why do you think so?
That's the only one left.
No, it's not the only one left. Yeah, this population average effect is when you run a regression analysis and you don't consider clustering effects at all. So you have no controls for the firm, which is the clustering variable here, then you will have population average effect. And if there is no contextual effect, or if there is no BP effect, then the population average and the BP effect are the same. So they pretty much everybody who doesn't think about this explicitly estimates the population average effect. And whether that's an accurate representation of what they're trying to model depends on the research question. Most other papers in management try to estimate the within effect. So it's typically either if there are any explicit consideration on the levels, it's the within effect that is estimated. You want to understand how firms action affect that firm's performance, how leaders' action affect that leader's followers, how individuals' actions affect that individual's health and whatnot. If it's not considered, then it's population matters. Between effect models are very, very, very manageable. Which effect should they estimate? So which effect would be this is a tricky question. So this is actually a hard question.
Would you be interested in the within effect?
Why would you be interested in the within?
Well, I'm putting myself in the position of a banker.
Mm-hmm.
So I would be a banker or working in the bank industry. Mm-hmm. I would be interested, okay, so what kind of strategy should we do for
that? So we are now not very strategically reliant. If we increase our strategic deviation, then how much would it affect our performance? Sure, the within effect, and this is the logic that most researchers apply. But there is a bit of a complication here. If you think about strategy, is the effect of strategy more of an effect of longer-term decisions, or is it more of an effect of what we make now? What kind of decisions we make now have an effect on now? Let's think about another variable. If we focus on R&D spending and effects of R&D spending on profitability. Is R&D spending's effect on profitability fairly immediate? So if we increase R&D spending, it increases profitability. Or is it more of, depending on our overall longer-term levels of R&D spending?
Maybe cumulative.
Cumulative R&D spending, that has been modeled, but we're just focusing on this between within the context. So if our profitability depends mostly on how much we have been spending on average on R&D over the last 7 years, for example. What is that effect?
It's time fixed.
Yeah. It's the contextual effect. So contextual effect is the effect of all the years on 1 year. So if we look at our profitability level Does it depend more on the R&D investment on that specific year, or does it depend more on the overall level across the full time frame? Probably the latter. And this is when we think about strategy. The difficult question is that if a bank changes their asset strategy, then how long will it take to affect their profitability? And if we make a change now, does it affect over the longer term? And if a bank changes their asset strategy, it probably takes some time for the customers to identify, okay, so this bank will also do this kind of assets they didn't do it before. And it might be more that your profitability depends on your longer term strategy instead of any individual year. It might depend also on a bit of both. So if it's a bit of both, that our decisions have short-term effect, but they also have this longer-term effect, then looking at the between effect might be useful. So
I was just like wondering, like realistically, speaking of strategy and research and development, it would also matter what kind of other companies are doing.
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of like this competitive advantage. So would this be considered contextual effect or between effect?
It depends on the level. So if you are looking at the clustering variables industry, and then you are looking at companies within the industry, then what other companies are doing and how that affects your performance, that would be contextual effect. So would if other companies are following diversification strategy, does that affect, or differentiation strategy, does that affect your profitability? That would be contextual effect within the industry. If we have industries, then we have companies within the industry, and then we have observations, multiple observations for each company. The contextual effect of certain deviation on performance would be how much my performance depends on my longer-term strategy, because when it's over multiple years, then it's longer-term. And this is more of an immediate, like I change my strategy now, it affects my profitability now, or is it more of like a longer-term effect? So that when you have longer-term data, but panel data, then thinking about these effects cannot be decoupled with thinking about what is the timeline. So this is really hard because it's longitudinal. We need to think about how long does the effect last? How long does it take to unfold? How about Mocom? Did they do within effect, between effect, contextual effect, population average? Is the light manipulation, the invitation to light manipulation, is that a within effect or a between effect? They manipulated the individuals into four different conditions and then invited them to light the paints, and they changed which kind of message they sent. Is it a within effect, between effect, or contextual effect?
Between effect, treatment.
Yes, it's a between effect because they only have one observation for each individual. Then you can only estimate the between individual effect. But you cannot decompose it into the within and the context. How about the others when they look at the effects of the boosting period? Is that the between individual effect or within individual effect? Sorry? It depends on a bit of how you look at the situation. When they have the model where they have the individual fixed effects, then that is a within individual effect. So they were looking at how does the effect of boosting, the within effect in boosting, how does it differ between the two different groups because they have the interaction model. But experimental studies typically are between individual effects. And this is mostly between individual effects, more honestly. Final example. Our paper that is the manuscript number is 2021. It's now 2024 that this paper is still under review. So we are now doing the fifth revision of the paper for this term. And so we wrote the first version, and then we have revised it five times, so that's sixth version of the paper. And now it's going to be accepted, so this is going to be one. We studied the effect of work-family conflict. So that means that your work interferes with your family responsibilities, like missing a family dinner, or working at home, answering phone calls at home, and neglecting your kids or your spouse. That is work-family conflict. Work interferes with family life. And then we studied the dependent variable of strain, so psychological strain, exhaustion, perceived stress were the two main variables. How would you start thinking about is the effect of work-family conflict on psychological strain? Is it a within effect or a contextual effect? We are studying individuals over time. So we have the clustering variables individual, and then we have repeated observations over time. Would you think that the effect is within individual or contextual? How many of you have family? How many of you have ever experienced poor family conflict? Yeah, so is the effect within? Doesn't mean that it when your work family conflict goes up, then stress goes up as well. And then when work family conflict goes down, stress goes down. That's the within effect. It follows, the variables are correlated over time within person. Or is it more about the stress levels tend to depend on the overall level of your work family conflict over a longer period of time?
It can be both.
Bit of both, but it's actually mostly contextual in our study and in other studies as well. So it depends mostly like your stress levels. If your work family conflict goes up, then it might be you might have a but then it, when it goes down again, you know that it's going to go away soon. So you have this one night when you have to work. You don't stress that much about it. But if you have to work every night, then that increases your stress levels. So again, we need to think about what is the effect something that is a result of longer-term accumulation? R&D spending on profitability would be effect of longer-term accumulation. Here, the work family conflict theory says that it is that this effect on stress, it's more of a process of accumulation. So you have like the longer term history matters a lot more than the current level. And when you think about profitability, the within effect or the contextual effect, you need to think about it and ask the question that is my dependent variable affected more by the current levels or by the history? And if it's history, then you go for the contextual effect. If it's the current levels, then you go to the within. There are many other ways of modeling this, but this is like just on the very basic level. Any other questions about the within effect, contextual effect, and the between? Modeling this is fairly simple. Like if you want the within effect, you include the industry, include the dummies, or you center the data. If you want the between effect, then you just take averages of each cluster and then have one observation for each cluster. If you want the contextual effect, then you calculate the average of your independent variables over the clusters, and you put those in addition to the original variables, and you run the request. What makes this hard is thinking about conceptually. So what does our effect look like? Because most of our theories are like just saying that when x goes up, then y goes up or y goes down. But they don't really talk about the time frames of the effect. And if you have a panel data particularly, then the time frame and the common effect, they can really cannot be separate. Another thing is that our study was, we had five different data, different studies. So we had one study where we surveyed people over a week every day. And then we had one study where we surveyed people over a month and week. And then we had a study of half of one quarter monthly, every 6 months and every 1 year. So what is the contextual effect in a week in a data study, one over a week, is a very different thing than what is a contextual effect for a study that runs over 3 years. So does the stress level depend on your weekly overall level for family conflict? Or is it more like that it depends on the level over 3 years? And yeah, and people can also respond differently. So all this needs to be thought about when doing a resource design. All right, we're going to do 10 more minutes because we started a bit late. Hopefully that's okay. We'll do a wrap up and have a piece of paper and write down 3 points that you found most interesting in all these units about regression analysis. Something that challenges your prior assumptions. Then 3 things about regression analysis that you found most important. Something that is going to be very, very impactful for your future research. So 3 points. Interesting, something that challenges your prior understanding, important, something that you think is going to be impactful. I'll give you 3 minutes. So 1 minute. Okay, time's up. Then pick a pair and compare your lists and come up with a consensus list of three interesting points and three important points.
Because actually,
well, if I was just thinking about the words, this one was really interesting. Like, you know, you have to think that independent independent. Because that would mean that it's a connection within itself. And then what Asuka was talking about earlier about. That their technical skills from neighborhood again moderation because that's that and the dogs testing at different levels of the what about you?
Yeah. So I just have yeah. Interesting report.
The excellent I think this was
the rolling and the you know how we were able to
Yeah.
And maybe the margin predictions looked quite decent. They were basically the discussion that we were having before the odds ratio directly depended on the problem. It's possibility, not that we can see how.
That's
good.
Yeah, and then let's use
knowing the distribution of your data. So what do you think about
I think that's how do I improve my
This is amazing.
So this is really all about one down to look at an interesting, like, important tool.
Well, I understand the
I think this one is the most important, because I just this one, and it's very important because many
most important
the
amount of
the
time,
but it's different. So it's definitely important.
When you have a list of three with your pair, then three and three with your pair, then join with another pair for a four-person group, and then you come up with a new consensus list. Then we'll see if they go to this
So should we look at the most interesting one for us? Let's go. What is the common one?
So
We didn't even make that.
So we have only three. And the second
part
is that
important. The other important thing was kind of like symbol can be good.
I think the first one says that you can always try a new model. Was at least something that I was mentioning, especially how simplicity turns out like a linear model fits better as much as the other one, which starts with intercept, which is just not accurate. But I think it's something that we can say together with if something is not scientific, like an interaction.
Well, for which
is important, but then it's
We already have an overlap source. Most interesting. We were talking about the contextual effect was really nice, that, you know, to think about whether the dependent variable is it affected by the independent variable or the history of the history. That's where the time take comes.
Find history.
Also, thinking about the simplicity, because we were also talking about using multiple models for different parts of
violations.
Instead of doing like what's super hard and models that you barely mathematically understand yourself, then just like some really good stuff, you know.
But I think we could, it's kind of like a merger with a simple model, or then, you know, of course, it's better idea to do. Have a simple model.
But
should we have any other interesting variables?
We still have
We were also talking about the megaphone. That could mean moderation. And you can split that data and see
that the data can be plotted.
The effect is differing on different levels of the independent.
In order then to compare with the real data and understand it. Makes sense, maybe there are some modifiers.
It's wrong, just because it's not.
Part of it's a generally related to the different assumptions of that.
So I think we have three important technologies
of every section. If one was a republic, I would argue that
Yeah, the other two was just broadly related to the different assumptions. One thing that I mentioned was related to kind of like related to like our support, for example, research.
That's actually as much as we can explain variation. It really doesn't go above assumptions.
That's important opportunities.
Yeah, then we'll just kind of choose in between this one. But I think we can say the data is this,
But you know, it's also interesting that everybody's like, if you can work with the model, what's the difference?
I'm not sure about jobs and formulate what this is and testing something else, but at least
what were the issues?
Let's wrap up. Try to come up with a consensus. Okay. Yeah, I'm hungry. So. Three important points that I'll tell you why.
So, we pointed out that it's important to plot the data always because first it can help you, maybe first to check theoretically your understanding how the data can behave, and then when you have the data, also like what is the relationship. Then we wrote that it's very important to first to check the assumptions of, like, for example, linear models, and then that if some assumptions are violated, we can still deal with them. For example, with endogeneity, we can deal with instrumental variables.
If you find good instruments, it's
a thing. And we have it maybe in the data, or if we can collect additional data. And then we also wrote that how much it is a link of how we can build the regression afterwards with the research design and how many different questions we can deal with on the part of the research design before doing the regression, actually, and how it will influence everything.
Okay. So it was plotting assumptions and the link with research data. Okay. You are important.
So well, we also like plotting. It's important for understanding and communicating data. And then we have, like, simple can be good. It can be just be like a very simple model, but actually understanding what you're doing and doing it correctly and contrasting it. Sometimes it's really doing it wrong, not really knowing what's happening. And then I guess for the third one, we were talking about understanding endogeneity. It seems to be like related to those assumptions. It seems to be, I mean, pragmatically speaking, the most.
And no bad controls that are the main causal mechanism for the outcome. Yeah, my list is plotting, then endogeneity, and then the levels of effects that within and between the curves. I work with panel data most of the time, so that is important for me. Okay, interesting. Very interesting points. Something that you can think about.
I could start this. So if something is not significant, for example, if the p-value doesn't show that it's significant enough, if you can challenge it, you can plot it and see if there's any kind of, like if it's still significant in another way, basically. And then the second one is that you should kind of know what you're interested in, because sometimes between and within effect can be like the opposite. So it's important that you kind of clarify what you're interested in and what you are studying. And then the last one is we learned that the violation of different assumptions can actually bring some opportunities.
Okay, good.
Should I start with the two things that we discussed?
Yeah, go ahead.
So first of all, we discussed that flaws in published work exist, and you should have your critical glasses on when reading published work and not take it for granted that because it's gone through the peer review process, it would be perfect. Another one we discussed related to this was the R2 squared, or how much does the model actually explain the phenomenon we're studying, like that it's basically about 20 or 30% that is considered a good model. And if we see a published work that they have published that, oh, this model explains 70% of this phenomenon, maybe some alarm bell should go in your head, is this actually so? Did they miss something, or is the work done correctly? And so that was the two that we discussed, but did you have
a
third one?
Yeah, and the third one was related to assumptions, like you were saying. What are different assumptions and what are the implications, and for example, how they may be considered as opportunities in some cases?
Yeah, my own interesting points is that distributions don't really matter for regression analysis. A lot of people justify the choice of Poisson, for example, because the dependent variable is a count. And that's interesting to find out that that's actually not the right thing to do. Then second is the methodological errors that you see in papers. That is interesting. And the third one that I found interesting is that these different levels of effects, because they aren't really discussed in papers. Like, should I focus on the within effect or between effect or contextual? I found that interesting, that kind of challenge my prior assumption. I've been thinking a lot about that in the last couple of years. All right, let's go for lunch. And then, so this was the final session of regression analysis, and now you will have my permission to use regression analysis in your quantitative articles.
Yay!